Welcome to Inspired Artist Podcast with me, Sirgun Kaur. This is a really exciting one for me to present to you because we had to do this in two parts, and I haven't done this before. My friend Joshua Stoddard, this really dynamic human being who has done so much in his life, and really he doesn't even get into 1% of it in the two podcasts we did. But he felt the need to give a little bit more information because the first part of this, as you're going to see, is a lot about the processing of death and illness. And so the second part of it goes more into what's happening now, the process by which he was able to heal his back and feel better, and just the mental, spiritual growth journey that he is going through right now. So I found this a fascinating conversation. I am excited to share it with you. And here we go.
Can you hear me clicking? I mean, typing?
Just but faintly. It's okay. Faintly.
Okay. If you hear that, I'm taking notes.
So that okay, cool. I don't think it's so loud that it'll distract me, but if it does, can I stop and say something?
I'll try to mute it when I do that.
Oh, okay, cool. I've learned about myself in the past few months that I have hypersensitivity. Yeah, and it makes sense, and I have compassion for myself around a lot of things, but phone calls can be very noisy, and it's like, man, it's one thing that can like totally stress me out if I'm, you know, if I'm not present to it.
That seems like something that would have been really obvious.
Right? I mean, it is, but
you're not really just discovering this, though, right?
No, not discovering, but I think maybe having more compassion for it.
Oh, okay.
For it. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. I used to think that, like, I should be able to get through this, you know? Mm-mm.
Oh, yeah. That's not productive, huh?
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I like that. So let's just keep going.
Cool.
So how are you in Portland now?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We drove through the other day. That was pretty fun.
Yeah.
I mean, through.
Well,
but around, I guess.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Did you go up I-5? You probably went.
Yeah. Through. Yeah. Did we go through like the middle?
Yeah. You went right through the middle.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. We didn't get to see much, and I didn't see you.
Yeah. Right on. Yeah. What was it? You made it. And mm-hmm. how long have you been in Seattle now?
Let's see, since Friday.
Cool.
So what, like less than a week?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm impressed that you're at it already and doing the podcast, and you just landed.
Yeah. Well, I like to get stuff done, and yeah, I wanted to, I didn't want to just like, you know, cause if I set aside all the time I needed to actually unpack, I think I would, you know, just not get back into my rhythm.
Yeah. Yeah, no, totally. When I move into a place, I feel like it's like I'm on tour. Like oh, doing another show, got to set all up, all the gear up,
you know? Yeah. Well, it was like that for a few days. I was like in hyperdrive, and and now I'm just like, okay, well, at least I have clothes in the closet, you know?
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. So nice. Are you doing some touring right now, or are you mainly just staying put?
Staying put for the most part. I'm doing a concert or a sound bath for Four Seasons in March.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, for the spa treatment package that I've put music together for, which you were a part of. And that is in the mixing stages right now. But that'll be done, and then they're really going to push it in the early 2020 in January, February, March.
Cool.
So the sound bath will be like it's part of their open house, and really to promote the sound bath treatment that they put together.
Oh, okay. So it's not like going to be played in their sauna. It's like part of a whole, I was curious about that.
Yeah, I was, yeah, I didn't tell you the whole thing probably, but it's intentional music that I made for a massage package that they've put together that it includes some, it's like a very thorough massage basically.
Wow. That's
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's like, neat to see Four Seasons do something as, I guess, what would have been considered a little bit new agey, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it makes me wonder, like, has a big corporate hotel or spa done something like this with sound? Is it the first one?
Yeah,
I wonder, like something that's like completely tailored to, I mean, I'm sure there's been intentional ambient music and whatever made for hotels, but like for like a spa or like a therapy treatment, like I wonder if this is the first one.
Yeah. Yeah, that was something that I was thinking about coming here because it's so, you know, there's so many big corporations where, mm-hmm. where I am. So I'm just outside of Seattle and uh-huh. there's like Microsoft and Intel and, well, Facebook is in Seattle, but I think they're moving and, mm-hmm. yeah, you know, the Bill Gates Foundation and like, there's just all these huge corporations. And my mom was like, you should see about, you know, she yeah. always thinks like this, you should go and ask if you could teach yoga. I don't want to teach yoga, but I think it would be really cool to, you know, I mean, that would be such a wonderful thing to have as part of, you know, a wellness mm-hmm. Package for employees who get overtaxed. And
yeah, Portland is pretty hip on that. Yeah. Nike and Intel have mindfulness programs. Yeah, I've done a sound bath for Intel, for employees at Intel.
Oh, that's so cool. So that's yeah. where my boyfriend works is in.
Oh, cool. Oh,
yeah,
nice.
So he could actually be in Portland, but he prefers to be in Seattle.
That's yeah. really cool.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, Misha, come yeah. up here and do it.
Yeah, I would love
do
that.
Something together. That would be fun.
Yeah, yeah, for real.
Yeah. So for those who maybe aren't aware, Joshua and I put together an album at the beginning of this year. It was complete. It was released on Mother's Day. That was dedicated to both of our mothers, who were both named Pamela. So we called it For Pamela. And it was my first sound healing album. It obviously wasn't yours, but that was pretty, that was a pretty easy and wonderfully synchronistic experience because we hadn't really ever met before we started. Well, we didn't meet before we started recording it. And then we met and found out we had the same mom. No, the same name.
Yeah.
That's like, that's the soap opera version.
Yeah, yeah. Right? It's all connected. The one. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'm so pumped about how that record came out. It's been really neat, like getting feedback on it too and just hearing what people's different experiences are with it. And so far out of everything that I've released, it's been the most impactful release that I've created. So thank you so much because you were such a huge part of that. It's like it really came together because of what you brought to the table. It just inspired me and really made it happen.
Yeah. It was really easy. I mean it was just like you sent me a track and I wouldn't even listen to it. I would go and put the headphones on and just whatever came out. You know, sometimes I edited it and sometimes I didn't. And it was just, yeah, it was fantastically flowy.
That's awesome. Well, that's how I like it to be with my music and what I'm realizing too, with like all music really.
Yeah.
It's like the first take is like, there's typically so much magic in the first take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's, it's like, you know, any recording past one take, then the mind starts to go into it more and start to over, it's like very easy to start to overthink things.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
I agree. I find though with recording vocals, I do a few takes only because it takes my voice a little while to warm up.
Yeah, I get that for sure.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. but I do agree with you. There's mm-hmm. there's a lot of magic in just letting it evolve and mm-hmm. yeah.
Well, and definitely with the music that I'm creating, the sounds mm-hmm. that I'm creating, it's like, I mean, that's what it's all about. It's just being present to what's trying to express itself in the moment with sound and just following that and trusting it and being open to it.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's definitely very flowy.
Yeah. It's interesting. And then when I listen to the track sometimes on that, I'm like, I think if you listen to it, you could imagine that we had some sort of plan for it because yeah. it did have, you know, there was some definite signs of orchestration, you know, mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. they are an illusion.
yeah. Right. I know. Yeah. It's all cohesive. It all works yeah. together, but yeah, it is an illusion. I mean, because there's no, you know, there's no click track. There's no,
right.
beats per minute. There's not even any like real chord structures right. for the most part. Right. So it's all just kind of magic, really.
yeah. 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 And so Candace, who did the viola on that, I really love playing with her because she totally gets she's a very intuitive player. Mm. So she really got the, you know.
Yeah. She didn't need sheet music. For it. yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Candace Combs. She's yeah. the perfect name, Combs.
totally.
Yeah. So I'm so pumped with how that came out. And I'm really pumped with how the Four Seasons record has come out with the vocals that you put on that.
Yeah. I'm excited to hear that. I will say though, I mean, I listened to you had two other albums before this one, right?
Mm-hmm. Volume 1 and Volume 2.
Yeah, I mean they were so beautiful. And
thanks.
And I remember listening to them on my way to Shakti Fest because I remember driving to the desert and just singing over it. I mean it's so nice for especially I think if you're not, you know, considering yourself a singer, just kind of making sound over it. It's very inviting.
Mm. I'm glad to hear you say that.
Yeah.
Because I hope that even in my sound baths that it feels that inviting. Because I've gotten to where I'm like more and more I'm encouraging and asking and inviting people to sing along with me, mm-hmm. whether it be in the sound bath or typically usually like a little micro sound bath at the end. So yeah, it's good to hear that it sounds inviting because I really want it to be so people can take on some of that, you know, the inner courage and empowerment and sing and become a part of it.
Totally. Yeah. I had the best feedback from, do you know who Sean Johnson is? Sean Johnson, the Wild Lotus Band. They're this
No.
kirtan group out of New Orleans. They're really amazing. They're highly musical. Like they're
cool.
They're very, I don't know, well-trained musicians. But mm-hmm. That was the first kirtan music that I ever heard. And I got a message from him a few weeks ago, because I actually asked him to be on the podcast, so hopefully that happened. But he said that he played our album for his son, who's a baby, and helped him sleep every night.
Wow.
And I thought that was so cool, like, because... Mm-hmm. He had, you know, he inspired me to do what I'm doing, and now he's playing this music.
Oh,
yeah. That was really cool.
You know, that's something that's like really special and neat for the world of the kind of music that you and I make is that there's a lot of people out there, or I don't know about a lot, but there's people out there that will play it regularly and it becomes a part of their life. And it's like, wow, what an honor. For that to happen, but yeah, it's like super special for him and his child, and then first it to be somebody that you look up to mm-hmm. or admire as far as their work goes. Yeah, it's been pretty neat, like just finding those sort of things out. Like I know somebody with the same record who basically for, I think it was at least a month, and it might still be going. This was several months ago. She was using it to sleep with every night. And it was actually just the one track, the To All track that you sing.
Oh, okay.
Peace to all, love to all. And mm-hmm. so that track she was using to sleep with, it was on repeat every night for at least a month, and it might still be happening too.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. So similar story, but you know, it's just, it's a really, it's a interesting experience, being, you know, how people use it in like a sort of medicinal way. The music that we make, just coming from a rock and roll perspective, how I used to be in rock and roll bands. And, you know, it was like in that world, I think you sort of put on something if like you're feeling a certain vibe, which I guess isn't too dissimilar.
Right.
But this is more just like, you know, intentional for like, for resting or for going to bed or, you know, different things. So it's not dissimilar, but I feel like there's more devotion within the world of music that we're doing now, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
It's interesting how songs will be necessary for you at different times.
Mm-hmm.
It's so funny. So I was listening on the way here. I must have listened to this track at least 100 times on repeat. And it was a cover of Fleetwood Mac's Landslide.
Oh, yeah. Which cover? Smashing
it's
Pumpkins?
It's this British. So I can't listen to his voice.
Billy Corgan.
I can't do it.
I get it. I get it.
It's just a personal thing. I'm sure he's a great human. It's Dagny, I think that's how you pronounce it. And she's British. It's so cool.
Cool.
But for whatever reason, you know, it's like, I think music means something to you because it's important for that time. But mm-hmm. I heard the lyrics in a whole new way. And, you know, it's about letting go and growing up. Mm-hmm. And here I was moving, you know, I was moving on from an 8-year marriage. And, you know, it just, you know, and at first it made me cry. And then I sort of settled mm-hmm. into it. And then, you know, it was like this whole evolution of this song. I think music, you know, different kinds of music can be used medicinally even, you know, I guess it sort of depends on your state.
Right. And what you're needing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Or like how intentional you're being when you put it on. Is it just like background music or you like super, I like you going there with an emotion sort of thing.
Yeah. What is your favorite thing to listen to on repeat?
I've been listening to, well, right now I can say it's always been Beck. I love Beck big time. Every different evolutionary stage of Beck's career, because he's been all over the place. He started off doing folk music and then it was kind of like indie folk hip hop and he's gone through, like, I feel like he's the Bowie of our time, the David Bowie of our generation. But right now, I'm really inspired by a band called HERS, HER/S.
Okay.
And I'm really fascinated by them. They have a really intelligent pop sound. Like, they're really cool pop musicians, but they're two young dudes that just came out of Liverpool, I believe. And I'm extra fascinated by them because they just blew up. And within the same year of blowing up and like doing their first world tour, they both died in a car accident.
Whoa.
Yeah. Like they were like England was like really looking forward to, I'm, you know, generalizing, but like they were, that country was really looking forward to this young up and coming band that they had going, and they've got like a million followers on Spotify, and they were blowing up. And then they died on their first tour.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy. What a legacy. I mean, that's,
I know. Yeah. Well, and the same thing just happened with, a hip hop guy, a rapper guy. I think he does kind of like trap music. But his name is Juice WRLD. I don't hardly know anything about him. And I don't know trap music or newer hip hop that much. But he, same thing. He just released a first, like 2018, I think was his first release. Mm-hmm. And he had blown up. He's even bigger than this other band that I'm talking about. He had just blown up. And actually in one of his songs, he said, what's the deal with 27s? And you know how those like Kurt Cobain, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, bunch of people that died at 27, like Amy Winehouse. Huh. There's this whole thing of like, that. Yeah, there's a whole thing in like the rock and roll world of like people dying at 27. Hmm. And he actually raps about that in one of his songs. And he said, I'm not going to make it past, I'm probably not going to make it past 21. And he turned 21 and a week later he died. Like he had a seizure in an airport while he was traveling. Yeah. Wow. So I'm really fascinated by death right now and music. So mm-hmm. it's like interesting that I've like come across these two like brand new artists that had blown up and then died shortly after.
Right. Yeah. You've had, I mean, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I'm totally. Yeah. It's the topic of my life right now.
Yeah. Well, tell me more.
Well, so my father died this year on August 24th, and it was the exact same day that my mother died 10 years before. So,
wow, I think I knew that, but that's
yeah. I mean, I have a reminder that pops up in my calendar for when my mother's death date comes up. Just so I'm aware of it, because sometimes you forget those sort of things, or it's like the subconscious, or you just like kind of want to block it out or forget mm-hmm. that it's there. But like underlying, I think that like emotionally we recall these things, whether we like actually recall it or not, like when an anniversary comes up. So I put it in my calendar, my mother's death date, and I had a 2-day reminder on it, and the 2-day reminder popped up like the day we were taking my father to hospice, and I was like, oh my God, he's going on the same day that my mom died. Like I knew it right then and there. And sure enough. Yeah. But it was like, he confirmed that like she was there and everything. It was trippy. It was.
Oh, so he talked about seeing her.
So the last thing that he said was, is I'm going to get on my horse and ride, which is a super awesome thing. I hope my final words are like that. And there's more to that story that I would love to share too. But mm-hmm. That was the last thing that he said verbally. And then we were just asking him questions because he went into like a coma sort of state, but he was still able to hear us and like confirm different things by squeezing our hand.
Oh, wow.
Because he wasn't able to physically talk, you know, towards the very end. So my sister asked if our mother was there, and he squeezed her hand really hard.
Oh,
yeah.
I remember you had a back issue and you were consciously choosing not to go there at first. Mm-hmm. And then, so at what point did you make it over to be with your dad?
Consciously now. Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. When he had a stroke, I thought he was, I've totally forgot about this actually. And there's so many things that happened this year. Hmm. It's been quite the year. So yeah, actually, thanks for bringing that up. It's something I need to think about. So yeah, he had a stroke, and this happened. I think I'd have to go back and look at the timeline, but I'm pretty sure it happened like the day after our album came out, or it was right after we had just finished mastering it, and it was like it was complete, it was done, and we could send it to the presses. It was after a monumental day mm-hmm. of completing and releasing, in my mind, like releasing finally this record, a record that I had wanted to make for my mother for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And it was like the day after it was done. Can't remember if it was actual release date, or I think it was when we were done with the production. When that was done, the day after my father had a stroke, and mm-hmm. I thought that was like pretty crazy timeline as well. But while that was going down, yeah, I had some really bad back issues, and it was so bad this summer that I couldn't, for the most part, sit or lay down without pain. So like traveling just, it scared me. It was, I was in a really bad chronic pain, trauma loop, all that sort of stuff. But it got to the point, it was just like a breaking point where I needed to go be with family. And at one point in the whole process, it was just sort of like a no-brainer. It's like, I'm in a stalemate. I'm stuck. Like, I can't go anywhere or do anything because of my back problem right now. So like, even though I don't want to travel to Florida, like, I just have to do it. It just like makes so much sense. It's like, I'm the only person in my family that can take the time right now to be there with my father. And I was talking with my brother-in-law about it. And it just made perfect sense that it was almost like the universe set me up to go take care of this time with my father. Mm-hmm. And my back, like the injury of my back was like the only way that that was going to happen, because I had a full summer worth of music festivals and touring and all of that. So if it weren't for the back issue, I definitely wouldn't have spent as much time with my father, but I would have gone for sure. But I ended up being there all summer with him because of it.
Sorry, I was just writing. I'm taking my notes about your, it's amazing how things happen. And then in retrospect, you know, if we have the clarity to see it, we can be like, oh yeah, that's really the only way that that could have worked out, because mm-hmm. I wouldn't have given myself permission to cancel all these events if I hadn't had enormous back pain.
Yeah. What's really interesting too is the same thing happened, not same, but very similar thing happened right before my mother died. I was on tour in 2009. With a rock band, and sort of felt like I was at like a pinnacle of my career. We were playing theaters, and it was just like a scenario where I was walking on stage, not having to do sound check, like the gear is already set up. Like, we were kind of rolling in like rock stars in a way, and like playing to sold out crowds. It was like this amazing climax of a moment of my music career, and I broke my ankle. Like three shows into it was like three or five shows into a 30 show tour. Uh-huh. And that right after that happened, is when my mom really started to decline. So I went from being on the road to an injury where I had to cancel everything. And then it was the same scenario. It was like, oh, well, I can go be with my mom I wasn't able to be with her as long as I was with my father, but at least I was able to be there for like a week before right at the end of her life.
Mm-hmm. So how long were you with your father?
It was 4 or 5 months.
Oh, wow.
It was all summer. Yeah, it was all summer, yeah.
Wow. So what was that like?
It was hell. Yeah. It was hell. There's so many different things that happened, but like I basically saw my father like go through hell, and I went through hell with him. And he was in terrible pain, like where morphine or fentanyl wouldn't really take care of it. Like, he was in that much pain, and it was just constant, and I was too. And it was really challenging, because the pain was so bad with me that I, like, there was times where I didn't want to sit in a car and drive the 10 minutes to get to him because the pain was so bad. So I spent most of my time in Florida pacing around his condo and just basically trying to avoid pain. I was in like this serious like trauma loop and was very confronted by life. It was hell. And it was like 90, 95 degrees and humid, super hot Florida. So I felt trapped. Like, I was trapped in his house. Like, I would go outside, but you know, if you're not acclimated to that weather being in the city, it's like,
right.
It was intense in a bunch of different ways.
Do you feel like something, like you broke through something as a result of that?
I do. I'm still processing and figuring out what it was, but my father had a really rough life. He was a farm boy, and, you know, not by choice. And I think a lot of farm boys are that way. It's like, you know, you're born into this family and you're going to provide and you're going to get out there at 4 a.m. and work on the farm. And I don't care if you're sick. Like, and that happened to my father, where he would just get pulled out of bed. He was sick at times, and then he just like get pulled out of bed and thrown down the stairs to like go milk the cows. And so he had this like very militant upbringing on the farm, which I think was pretty common back in those days. And it was very hard on him, because he was very rigid and very strict. But at the same time, he saw through that and he saw the other side of it. And he had this like grace to him, where he's like, he understood his conditioning, and there was some value of it, of the discipline, but, you know, discipline by choice and not being forced to. But he had this like, he had this really rough upbringing that I think if you ask me, carries on to his father and probably to his father. And it's just like this sort of thing that's just been happening throughout my family and generations for a long time. And I think what's at the core of what I went through with my father was like a lot of like really becoming present to a lot of that rigidness and like completing it in a way. And like, I think it came up so intensely for both him and I, so we could both confront it and be with it, and hopefully transform it in the end.
That makes so much sense when you think about your back, because your back mm-hmm. is like the symbol of your flexibility, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's been really profound.
I mean, and how interesting that you had to put aside your quote unquote responsibilities in order mm-hmm. to be with him and really honor your body, which was something that he was never able to do too.
Right. Well, and another level of it too was within all of it, I just really wanted to be there for him. And there was a level of it where I was doing that for everybody else too. Like I was putting other people first and worrying about other people, and not, instead of, you know, really just centering and taking care of myself so I could show up and be there for people. What I realized was I was doing that basically with the sound baths and how many I was doing. I did like 400 in 2 years and 100,000 miles. It was just extreme. Mm-hmm. And I think that factors into it too. But something that I went through with my father was when my back was hurting so bad, I was having to choose myself instead of like overextending myself again. To drive, you know, it doesn't seem like much, but to drive 10 miles to go be with him in my back, like it would just, sometimes it would put me in a worse position to go that little distance in a car. So there was days in a row where I'd have to choose, like, I'm down here to be with my dad, but my back hurts and I'm going to not go see him today, even though he's in hell. And mm-hmm. really need some family support. I had to like choose myself, and it was like the hardest decision, because my family member, you know, my father is laying in a bed like 2 miles away and I'm choosing to not go see him. And that was super hard on me. But I realized that within all of that, that like in a way it was like kind of creating room for him to let go.
Yeah.
Because if I had showed up every day and babied him and been there for him, you know, and really overextended myself, that would have been in like a form of attachment and that could have happened in both ways. So I think by me creating space for myself, I think in a way it helped both of us let go.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. I think people stick around for longer because they feel that, well, first they're scared to leave, and also because mm-hmm. they feel that people are going to, they're, you know, they're holding on for the people around them too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Otherwise I think we would die quicker.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause he had like a dozen infections, like C. diff and staph. And it was just like, he had some serious infection. It was amazing. He lived for as long as he did at the end. And it was, I believe that it was, he and I had some stuff to work out together, and he definitely, you know, not making it all about me. He definitely, I spoke with him about how he was being taught patience, like, because he just wanted to go. He was ready. Mm-hmm. He was ready to go, but he was very clear in telling me that he was being, that the lesson for him at all was just to be patient and to allow and the grace of all of that. Yeah.
Wow. I think it's amazing that it's just reminding me how we're taught that we should be there, like physically there for people kind of no matter what. And right. if you've ever been with someone who doesn't want to be where they are, then you know that it's better not to have them there than to have them there and resenting you for it, you know?
Right.
Or totally. Not having, you know, like it doesn't feel good to make someone do something for you or something they don't really want to do.
Oh my God. Yeah. I definitely learned a deeper layer of that. Yeah. It's like, cause if I was there hanging out with him and I started to be in a lot of pain, I realized that it was like something that he could pick up on. And yeah, it goes a long way to say, it's like, you know, if I'm going to be there for somebody, I need to authentically fully be there. And not just feeling like I have to or to be forced to be there. It's a really good point.
Yeah. And again, you sort of had no choice because.
Yeah. It was a paradox. Man.
Wow. So you got back. Did you stick around after he died? Like through August or September?
Yeah, I did. And the story gets crazier, really, as far as like hell and the intensity of it. His memorial was a month later. But I had a back treatment that I was getting done. Gua Sha. Have you heard of Gua Sha? Mm-mm. It's like a scraping technique. Oof. That works at the fascia. Yeah.
Does it sound as awful as it sounds?
Yeah, it was really painful. And my back and my leg was like black and blue after treatments. Like it was like, and right on top of where it was already so tender and sore.
Did it help?
It did, but I had to get through it. And what happened was, is I found something called kratom, which is an herbal opioid, which I didn't know was an opioid at the time. And I had researched it, but not enough. I take responsibility big time. But I had spoken with people that were selling it. That's like, you can get it at CBD stores. This is in Florida, but you can get it almost anywhere, like gas stations.
Uh-huh. Hold on. I mean, opium is herbal though, right? I mean.
Yeah, then there's a process to make it opium, right?
Okay, so this is slightly different because it's not as processed?
I don't know.
You don't know. Okay, anyway.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. So this is like, it's a leaf. And then imported from Indonesia. I believe it's a leaf. Uh-huh. I could be wrong on that. But it's made into a tea or like capsule or powder form. Uh-huh. But it's magic with pain. Like, and so another thing to note is I don't have health insurance. So, being a touring musician, I haven't really needed to like go to the hospital or anything. So I've gotten by for 20 years of my adult life without having health insurance. But I found this herbal opioid.
Oh, as an aside, that's another great reason to join the Recording Academy. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I know. I don't know why I keep putting that off.
Because they have that Music Cares thing.
Yeah. And I've done stuff with Music Cares too when I worked at Gibson. So I started taking kratom, which worked. Like I had never had pain relief like I had with this, and it worked for 2 weeks. And they told me at the store that it was addictive, and I knew going into it that I was like, okay, I'm only going to take this for a couple of weeks just to get through this pain, like this portion. And after the 2 weeks was up, I just stopped taking it. And I was like, my back was feeling better. And I'm just like, I just quit. But I didn't know how addictive and how like, I didn't know it was an opioid. I didn't know that at the time. And for 7 days, I had the worst withdrawals. Like I got compassion for friends of mine that have died of heroin and different things of like, cause I was in the rock and roll world, still am, still connected to that. I've lost quite a few friends to heroin. And painkillers and different things like that. So while I went through this like 7 days withdrawal, it was like I learned so much compassion for people that have been have gone through that. It was hell. It was the, like, you know when you throw up, like that moment before you throw up?
Yeah.
That feeling, that feeling. It was like that nonstop for 7 days.
Oh my God.
Was like the, how they portray it in films doesn't sum it up. It doesn't. Yeah. It was hell. It was hell in his memorial.
I think that is my worst, my least favorite feeling, nausea of anything.
It's so unsettling. It's
if,
like,
if I had to rank it, you know,
right. Yeah. I mean, it's like your equilibrium gets thrown off. It feels like I don't know the whole science of it, but it's just like nothing feels okay.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I went through that for seven
days. Kind of like what the first trimester of pregnancy felt like.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
Although not while you sleep, but yeah.
Wow. That's intense. Yeah. Y'all mothers are
I don't know that mine was as intense as an opium withdrawal though, so I won't make it out to be that dramatic. And the second time around was really nothing, but I'm just thinking there probably are women who go through their first trimester with that much nausea though.
Mm-hmm.
I know. Wow. So that's so intense.
This was like into the, his memorial was on the seventh day of my withdrawals.
Sorry. I don't mean to.
No, it was crazy.
It is kind of funny though.
I know, for real. It was like, you couldn't have timed this. Like, it's just like, I was blown away the whole time. I'm like, wow, I had to go through this.
Wow.
Like so this wasn't that long ago. This was about 2 months ago. But so went to his memorial, barely made it through that, like just crawled pale-faced like to the memorial. And then the next day we flew to Michigan with my sister, her husband, and their two daughters, my nieces. We flew to Michigan, and the day we got back to Michigan, my brother-in-law's father went in the hospital and he died that week.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So it was like, it was intense, man. Like,
that's a lot of death.
It was a lot of death. And like, I mean, the just, patriarchs, you know, too, you know, like
people, not fathers. Even just people, but like when you consider the, you know, the death of your tour and the death of your father, and also the recall of your mother's death, and then the death of your opioid addiction, and the, you know.
Yeah, all of those things. Yeah. And I don't know, I feel like I'm being called to do more work around death. Like, I've done sound baths for end of life. I've done a sound bath for a Lutheran pastor, and I've done several other, and then I've just like coincidentally been at spaces where people had just passed away, or like a therapy horse even. But I've just been around it a lot, and I feel like I'm being called to make music to help, you know, people find peace and harmony within all of it.
Yeah, that seems like such a great, the only word I was coming up with is market for that, that could use a little bit of dignity in its, you know, in its practice.
Yeah, our culture has a skewed view of death. And of darkness too, if you ask me. It's made me think about like, the light and dark, and I've thought a lot lately about like it's almost like we're extreme in this, like everything's good morning or happy birthday or like good vibes only. And we're in this, like, I feel like our culture is like in denial about darkness or like, you know, the end of things, completing things.
It's bizarre. I remember thinking that when my friend died in college, and it was really hard because it was the first person in my life that was important to me that died. And her mom was treating it like it was this like absurd thing that never happens to anybody. And I remember one of our friends bringing it up that, you know, other cultures, you know, they view this as a part of life, and it's, you know, it's treated a lot differently, and you actually see the bodies, and, you know, there's like a celebration or whatever. I mean, different cultures do it in different ways, but it's so fascinating to me that it's always this surprise, you know?
Yeah. It just seems like our culture isn't really prepared for it.
Yeah.
Like, and I don't know. I'm just curious in like why it almost, like I said earlier, almost seems like we're in denial about it. It's like, we'd rather it just not happen and just like, all right, we'll go to the memorial and then hopefully the grieving will be done after
right,
that.
Right. Right.
Or like, yeah, I don't know. The idea of that has in my thought process has like bled over into like how I look at movies and like, and media or different things that come up. Like for instance, the movie Joker, like I saw that and I thought it was a great movie, but I caught myself after watching it, like telling people like Joker, it's a really good movie, but it's really dark though. And I was just thinking to myself, I'm like, what is that though part about, you know, like, is that make it bad? Because, you know, I mean, so there's so many different ways you can look at it. It's like, it's violent. So like, I don't really like condone violence, but at the same time, there's this underlying or glooming darkness that like, I think is villainized or like labeled as being bad, though it's a necessary part of the process, just like death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And then you look at things like how your back pain allowed you to be with your father in his, you know, last few months. And so you could go, well, okay, right, the back pain was bad. Well, it wasn't, it was necessary. For the process.
Yeah. Well, that's, I guess what I'm getting at is there's like grace in everything, you know? And I think that there is so much grace to be had and found within the darkness.
Oh, I like that. I think I might use that as the title of this episode.
Yeah. I mean, because ultimately that's where we learn from, right? It's like when we're happy and when we're glowing and we're joyful, we can learn things, but it's like, I feel like they're micro as opposed to like the macro, like huge eye-opening lessons that can happen within the darkness.
Right. Well, and here's the thing. You're going to be shown contrast anyway. So you don't have to necessarily go seeking out drama and darkness.
No,
in fact, you don't. Because you will see enough, you know, on your own.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, and another thing I'm having to be aware of, even with within what I was just saying, is like now I'm sort of starting to get in the mindset of like almost glorifying the darkness. And that's something I have to be aware of, because my first band that I, the working title of the first band that I was professionally in, I don't feel right saying professional, but the first band that I was serious about in my 20s, we were calling ourselves the Depression Era. And so there's been this side of me that is definitely very fascinated by the darkness. And I love melancholic music. I like the sadness, but I think that there is an element of that where it's like the comfortable, like it's like just so easy to just go slip right into the darkness. Mm-hmm. And so that's something I'm having to be aware of too, but it's really, you know, again, just comes back to balance really.
Yeah. Yeah.
Having awareness around it.
Wow. Well, if people would like to find your music online, how should they go about doing that or find you?
Spotify is what a lot of people use. Joshua Stoddard, you can find me there, or my website, joshuastoddardsound.com, and there's links on there to everything.
Sweet. Well, have a great rest of your Thursday, and I will see you soon.
Bye. Sounds good. Okay, bye.